Okay, here we go. Now we're recording and we're good to go. Okay. Now with the schedule, I don't think that we need to be like slaves to the schedule. So if we have more that we need to talk about one day, you know, we can move things around. If what I'm saying is boring and we just want to skip over it, just raise your hand and say, let's skip over this. Unless I think it's really important, then I'm not going to skip over it. But I just want this, I mean, I don't want these to be just set in stone, but we do have 8 chapters and we have 11 classes, and so I think there's some time for some introductory material as well as some time for us to, you know, kind of change what we're going to be looking at each time. And so if we want to spend more time on a particular section, we could go ahead and do that. So it'll give us some more time to look a little more in-depth. Any other questions before we go into the introduction? As you can see tonight, I have a little more introductions set than I normally would. I don't know, when I was in school, I always wanted to get right to the text. You know, I didn't like all this introduction stuff. And here I am, I have 2 classes full of introduction. What do you think about that? Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at Thessalonica, a little bit about the city, and hopefully it'll help us to kind of have a background. I think it's good before you get into any text of the Bible to look a little bit, as far as you can tell, about the setting in which it's placed. Because if you don't know the context in the overall, you know, library of Scripture and in history, you're going to be able to get a lot of good things out of it, but you're not going to get the real key that you need to if you don't get the background. So I'm trying to get my remote here to work, and it's not really working, so let's see here. Having technical difficulties already tonight. Maybe I need to move this way. Okay, let's see. See if this will advance. If not, I'm just going to move over there and do a... Okay. We'll go? Oh, here we go. Okay, let's hope and pray it keeps going. Okay, the history of this city of Thessalonica. Thessalonica is kind of a city that was planted for a particular purpose. You know, some cities just crop up because of people necessarily wanting or needing to live someplace. Thessalonica, even though there was some civilization there before it was really planted, was really planted by Cassander in 315 BC because he wanted a good port city. So it kind of reminds me of the other day I saw something on TV about Washington, D.C., and there's a strategic reason why Washington, D.C. is located where it is. I mean, when we founded our nation, it was basically woods, right? But Washington thought that whoever controlled the Potomac would have kind of a key advantage in any war situation. And so because of that, he chose to, you know, relocate to D.C. Well, in a similar way, I'd say that Cassander in 315 B.C. was trying to make this this place that would be a very key position kind of planet. And his wife, you see the effigies here, guess what her name is? Thessalonica. So where do you think he got it from, right? Then later, after the Macedonian Empire, the Romans conquered it in 168 B.C., and so by the time Paul came to the city, it was, you know, this really important city. Wealth had grown quite a bit in the city, and it had this famous Ignatian Road that went right through the heart of the city. The 2nd century B.C. is when the Romans built this road. And what does Galatians 4:4 say about the preparation for the gospel of Christ? It says, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman made under the law. Now, what's involved in the fullness of time there?
to your point, those roads for easy travel and easy moving around.
Yeah. So part of, you know, you have the Greek language, we usually talk about that, or you have different, you know, different things that were in the world at that time that were conducive to the spread of the gospel. Well, one of them was these roads, right? And here in red you see this Ignatian road, and then in the blue you see kind of the sea route, and then in the yellow you see the Appian way. But this really connected all of Macedonia and a lot of, you know, Greece and even Asia Minor over here was kind of connected by it. So Rome, you know, over there would be to the left. Rome was able to kind of flex their muscle all across the empire because of this great Ignatian Road. Well, what do you think that did? You see, it goes right here through Thessalonica. What do you think that did for commerce for this place? You think their economy benefited a little bit? So you have this port city here on the Thermaic Gulf, and it's right on this Ignatian Road. And Paul, when he comes through here, he actually comes to the Ignatian Road. He comes from Troas up to Philippi, and then go to Acts 17 and look with me at verse 1. Acts 17 and verse 1. Acts 17, and we're going to be spending a lot of our time here tonight in Acts 17 because it's the background of Thessalonica and Paul coming into Thessalonica. And so we're going to kind of give that background first. Acts 17, verse 1 says what? Mark Parks, you want to read that?
And when they had passed through Amphipolis, Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews.
Okay. Now, in Acts 16, where is Paul? We have the story in Acts 16 of Lydia and the jailer.
Philippi.
So, you know, Paul hears that Macedonian call in Acts 16, and so he goes. He's been doing work in Asia Minor, and so for the first time he goes over to Macedonia. He sees that, you know, man of Macedonia saying, come help us. And so he goes to Nicopolis and then to Philippi. And he does some evangelistic work in Philippi. Was there a synagogue in Philippi?
No.
Because what happened with Paul and his converts there? Usually he'd go to the synagogue, wouldn't he? But where did he have to go at Philippi? To the riverside, where prayer was wont to be made, right? And so that's where he meets Lydia. Well, after he gets thrown in prison at Philippi and then goes out of there and stays at Lydia's house for a little bit, Acts 17 opens with him traveling from Philippi. And notice it says, as he went through Amphipolis and Apollonia. Now, Luke doesn't record any preaching there. There might have been some preaching there, but it seems from the way Luke records it that they just passed right through there. And see this dotted line, I don't know if you can see it. This is the Ignatian Way, and he comes into Thessalonica. Now, when he leaves Thessalonica, where does he go?
Berea.
Berea, which is pretty much along, I mean, the Ignatian Way goes left, goes west here a little bit, but then it doesn't go through Berea. So apparently at some point he broke off. But Paul is going down probably this big flagstone road that the Romans had built in the second century. And so, you know, because of that big road, the Via Ignatia, which, by the way, is named after the commissioner, which I have his name in the second paragraph there. Because of that, he's able to come through. Now, a place like Thessalonica had a port, and it also had this great road that ran through it that connected all of the empire. So there's all these people going in and out, and there's all this trade, and the spread of ideas from Thessalonica, just, you know, Thessalonica is a key place that if you wanted to spread an idea, if you put it in Thessalonica, it'd go all over the world, wouldn't it? Do you think that fact was lost on Paul and his companions? When Paul was going around and preaching, what was his MO when it came to spreading the gospel different places? Did he go just in the outskirts, go to little, you know, podunk place, or What did he do? What was his strategy?
He just went to the synagogue over places.
So he went to the synagogue and he went to particular cities, didn't he?
He went to very populous locations and spread the gospel there, and then left, and then let them spread it to the outlying regions.
And that's exactly what that's exactly what he was going to do here in Thessalonica. If you go to 1 Thessalonians and you look at what happened because of Paul going there, go over to our first textbook, 1 Thessalonians, and look at chapter 1 and verse 8. And Jenna, will you read that for us?
1:8. For from you the word of the Lord has sounded forth, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place. Your faith toward God has gone out so that we do not need to say anything.
Okay, so it's sounded forth. That's the idea of kind of like a thunderclap that echoes. That's the idea there. So Paul had that in mind, and he knew that Thessalonica would be the prime location for that. And so their faith, even though they hadn't been Christians very long, their faith had a ripple throughout the empire because they were in such a strategic location. Does that make sense to everybody as far as the where a place is situated? Are there some congregations that I know that we're not so much built and dependent on physical roads anymore, since we have the internet and things like that. But are there congregations that have been very influential due to their location, even in our society? Yeah, so Thessalonica is this really key geographical position, okay? And I think that if we look at some things in the book of Acts, we can find that the church of Thessalonica had some members in it that were travelers. They were, they were people that would go all over the world. I mean, it wasn't big for them because Thessalonica was such a traveler's city. Look at a few of these passages with me. Let's go to Acts 20 and verse 4. And we've got two guys that are mentioned here in Acts 20 and verse 4. Who would like to read that? Buck, do you want to read that for us?
Sophater, the Berean, son of Perus, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus, and Secundus, and Gaius, and Derbe, and Timothy, and the Asians, Tychicus, and Trophimus.
All right, thank you. I gave you the very easy verse there, didn't I? See, you said you were going to test me, and I struck first blood, didn't I? Okay. So we have two people here from Thessalonica, right, in Acts 20 and verse 4. And they apparently, were with Paul. Aristarchus was with Paul, for instance, in the theater. If you go back to chapter 19, you'll find in the theater in verse 29 that Aristarchus is there. When the whole city was filled with confusion, having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. Or if you go to the very end of the book of Acts, in Acts 27, in verse 2, entering a ship of Adramidium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia, one Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And so Aristarchus seems to be with Paul in some of these defining moments, even going probably in the trip, the final trip to Rome that we have in the book of Acts. Jason's mentioned in Acts 17 in our little narrative here of what happened in Thessalonica. We have Jason who was brought kind of before the rulers of the city, and he's charged for kind of harboring Paul and his companions. And Jason is mentioned in Romans 16, one of those chapters that has all these names in it, and it seems to be the same Jason. Now, I can't say that beyond any shadow of a doubt, because just like today, there were people that had the same names, you know. So we're making the assumption, I suppose, that Jason was the one that is mentioned in the Roman letter that was written from Corinth, and Acts 20:1-3 would kind of give that idea. So so what are these little snapshots of these people that are traveling with Paul? What does that show us about, as far as the Thessalonian influence? I'm going to go ahead and move over here, so maybe my remote will work. How about that? And if it doesn't, I can hit it with my hand. So, what do these little snapshots show us? Yeah, they lived in a place that people were coming and going all the time, and so they had an effect on all of the world, really, didn't they? And so that's kind of the strategic location. Everybody good on that? Did we spend enough time on that? Okay, let's go to the history then of the city. To understand a people and their mentality, do you have to know a little bit about their history? Is the history of America important to what you think about and what you hold dear? You think about if Jerry had grown up in some European country. You know, he's been over to Europe, right? Would you have some of the same ideas that you have now? Depends. You know, I mean,
most likely not. It's a different culture.
Yeah, I mean, your guns and all that stuff. I mean, depending on the country over there, you might not have had that situation, right?
Hurt me down deep saying that. True.
So thankfully, you were born here in America, right? In the good old eastern part of Kentucky. So let's notice a little bit about the history of the Macedonians before we go on to further matters about the actual time that Paul spent there in Thessalonica. This goes back to Alexander the Great, and I think most of us have heard about him. He's mentioned in the book of Daniel. He's called the horn on the goat. So sometimes I call him Alexander the Goat rather than Alexander the Great. But he conquered much of the then known world, and he died at the age of 33. And so he was remembered for years because of his, just because of all that he accomplished in a short time. He was even thought of as almost like a god. And so he is he's the son of Philip of Macedon. He really starts off this Macedonian kingdom. And when he died, his generals, they got the different parts of his kingdom. And so one of the generals got this area of Macedonia, and this is after Antipater, which was kind of his, regent, died. And one of the generals' names was Cassander. Now, we've already talked about Cassander, haven't we? He was the one who built the city. So apparently, when Cassander, here's Alexander the Great, and here's Cassander, and this is where we are right here, Thessalonica, okay? So Cassander kind of got that area because he had married Thessalonica, who was actually a stepsister of Alexander the Great. I mean, she was the daughter of Philip as well, just by, a different wife, and so I guess by marriage or something. But anyway, the situation was she was a stepsister of Philip, and so a stepsister of Alexander the Great, daughter of Philip in that way. And so you have this great Macedonian kingdom that, is ruling the then known world. But after Cassander kind of built the city of Thessalonica and established it as that port city, after he died, there was some unrest for a while until they had to kind of get together and meet a rising power in the West. Who was going to take Greece from the Macedonians? What was the rising power in the West?
Rome.
You read the book of Daniel. Daniel 2, you have Babylon, and then Medo-Persia, and then the Greek Empire, and then the Roman Empire, right? And so the Romans are the ones that are kind of this force to be reckoned with in the West. Well, they have these battles for a while, but eventually they kind of have to, they're put in subjection to Rome. And Thessalonica is conquered, and it's under Rome's control. Now, when Rome first kind of took took control of the city, they acted like they were grand liberators. You know, we've set you people free because, you know, you had this monarchy that was oppressive before. But really, all that Rome saw was dollar signs. Right, I mean, they just wanted to use any resources they had, whether it was their mines or their forests or whatever, and tax them heavily and really kind of just milk Thessalonica for all it was worth. And so for years, there was kind of this idea of a resistance where people will try to overthrow Roman domination. But as they continued to do that and be unsuccessful, eventually those ideas of a revolt were kind of extinguished. Okay, so by the time Paul comes into the city, it is very loyal to Rome because by that time, for years they had had protection from the Roman military. You know, there was, like, from the north, there would be these invading barbarians that the Roman soldiers would fight off and protect because they didn't want their land raped or anything. And so the Macedonians were thinking, hey, this is not too bad to be under Roman, you know, domination. At least they'll protect us from these, you know, roving bands of barbarians that are trying to come in and pillage and plunder. And so, by the time Paul comes into Thessalonica, it's a very loyal city to Rome. But I think that the Macedonians, if you study history, I think that they had not lost their historical identity. They still had this idea that they were really descendants from that great Alexander Empire, that they were still Macedonians at heart, even though they enjoyed the policies and the protection of Rome. And I think that's important to think about because what would the idea that the Macedonians or the people in Thessalonica are submitting to a new king, Jesus, what would that do to this idea of Roman dominion? Do you think that would, in some people's hearts, kind of rekindle this idea of having their old monarchy back they once had? So I don't know how much a part that, I mean, I tried to dig into the history a little bit, and I don't know how much of a part that played in what they did, but maybe there were some latent hopes of that, you know, kind of that awakened when the idea of king, that Jesus was a king. Of course, was Jesus a political king? Was he trying to incite some political movement to take over the world like Alexander had before him? No, he wasn't, was he? So, like, for instance, the Jews used this. The envious Jews in Acts 17, they used this against Paul and his companions. Let's go ahead and read Acts 17 and look at kind of what happens when Paul comes into Thessalonica. So I'm going to go ahead and read with you just verses 1 through 9, and apologize if I'm being like, if I'm stopping a little bit, but my remote's not working at all tonight. And I was really depending on that. So let's read Acts 17, verses 1 through 9. Says, now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. And some of them believed, and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks a great multitude, and of the chief women not a few. But the Jews, which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company, and set all the city in an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. And when they had found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, these that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason hath received, and they all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus. And they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And when they had taken security of Jason and of the other, they let them go. So, what's the accusation that the envious Jews bring when they bring them before the rulers of the city? Jason and his companions?
Preaching another king.
Yeah. Now, Jesus was a king, but is that kind of an unfair way to spin things? Did Paul or the Thessalonians that were converted to him, were they teaching that there was some other rival to Caesar in the sense of a political...
They had no political aspiration.
Do you think that that serves as kind of a lesson for us today? Do you think that people that are against Christian values in this nation are good at spinning things a certain way so that we as Christians look as though we're wicked, bigoted, mossbacked people that cling to our Bibles and our guns or whatever, like a do you think they use that in a way to kind of disparage us? Now I don't think we're as in serious condition as the Thessalonians were. We might be, you know, as years go by, but I do think that you kind of have a similar situation that you can think about here. Revelation 17:14 says Jesus is King of Kings, but his kingdom is not earthly. You know, John 18:36, what did he say before Pilate? My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. And so, just as the Jews had done before Pilate, you remember in John 19:12, they said, if you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. Right? Just as they had done there, what are they doing? The same thing. You know, they're using this as a way to kind of spin things to get the Christians in trouble with the Romans. And so that's what they do here. Now, in looking at the way that the government of the city is kind of set up, and of course my remote didn't work here, so let me just show you a few things here. This is the city today. Let me just break here and catch you up on this. And it has some really similar thing. It's called Thessalonica or Thessaloniki. It's the second largest city in Greece. It's called one of the best party cities in the world. So I don't know, but pretty similar, I guess. From the first, there's a Jewish population of over 50,000. So there's still strong Jewish population there, and it's a kind of a tourist center. But I kind of wanted to look a little bit at the government of the city. And I had more to mention on those slides, but they weren't really working for me, so sorry about that. But as far as the government of the city, since we're talking about Jesus being kind of painted as this rival king to Caesar, there was one interesting thing about Thessalonica as far as the city. Thessalonica was considered a free city in Rome. Now, what does that mean?
They could govern themselves.
Okay.
Oftentimes free from taxes. A lot of taxes.
So they did not have to have occupation, from Roman military. You know, they didn't have a garrison of Roman troops there. Okay. And it was an extremely coveted status, you know, because Rome's not breathing down your neck, they kind of let you. And Rome only gave that status of a free city to cities that were extremely loyal to the emperor. Okay, I mean, if they showed, you know, just complete and utter devotion to the emperor, then, you know, that was part of keeping that status. Okay, and so in Acts 17 here, you notice that when they get in trouble with the authorities, when Jason and the brethren that are with him, notice that there are two groups that are mentioned here. Verse 8, look at verse 8. They troubled, notice, the people and the rulers of the city. The people, the demos. Today we have the idea of demagogue or demographic, you know, it means people, that's the Greek word. So these were free citizens in this free city. So they were the ones that kind of governed themselves, right? And then the rulers of the city, and you know, I give the name for that, the politarchs, were the rulers that were chosen among these free citizens, okay, of the city. And so they were the ones that were going to take care of this. Now, hold your place there and go over to the next chapter and kind of compare what's going on here with Acts 18. If you go to Acts 18 in Corinth, when Paul kind of gets in and his companions start preaching in Corinth, and there's kind of an uproar there. Notice verse 12 says, "And when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia," that word "deputy" is the proconsul. Okay, that's the Roman proconsul has charge over that area. Now, I think in Thessalonica there probably was a Roman proconsul, but they don't. The King James Version doesn't say the deputy was sent out. Who are they brought before? Just the rulers of the city. So there's kind of a difference here between Corinth and Thessalonica. Thessalonica says, we're going to handle this. Rome doesn't need to step in. Okay? Why do you think that the rulers of the city were so quick to jump in and handle it themselves rather than Rome having to jump in?
They lose their status.
Yeah, they don't want to lose that status of being a free city, do they? And so they want to give any picture. They don't want to give any picture to Rome as if there's some sort of movement going on that would not worship him as a god, right? I mean, they worship the emperor as a god, and so they're going to be very quick to jump on anything that's kind of perceived in that way. Okay, so you can see how they would take this so seriously when they bring Jason. And they said, they've turned the world upside down. They've come here, and they all do things contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king. I mean, is it any wonder that the people and the rulers of the city took that so seriously? You're threatening Caesar, and we don't want to lose our free status here. So these people are going to handle it themselves. Now, I think the rulers of the city had some... certainly had authority in the city, because notice what they do in verse 9. They take security of Jason. Does anybody have another version? Buck, what do you have? In Acts 17, verse 9.
When they had taken money as security from Jason, and the rest they let him go.
Okay, money as security. So I think that's more of the idea. It's the idea of a bail, kind of setting bail, I think, is probably the idea there. So the idea is that they kind of kept him in hold and then took some bail so that they would. And verse 10 says, "And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night." So I tend to think, in piecing this all together, Paul says in his letters that he intends to return back there to Thessalonica. But I tend to think that maybe the rulers of the city just bound Jason under general terms that he would keep the peace. So, you know, listen, you don't need to stir up anything here. And so maybe Jason said, okay, we'll do what we can to keep the peace. And so they just decided, well, maybe it's best if Paul and his companions go on, and we'll just try to do what we can to help the church here. And so I don't think that Jason agreed that that Paul would never come back or anything like that, but I just think that he said, we'll try to keep the peace right now, and just kind of complied, at least in a measure, in that way, to what they were asking. Does that make sense to everybody? So they didn't want the Roman occupation, and they wanted to keep that idea of them being a free city, okay? Now, the next thing I want to look at kind of goes in with this idea of the idea of the government of the city, because the government and the religious aspects of the city kind of go hand in hand, okay? And I just want to introduce this idea first, and then we'll kind of take our break. In the Roman Empire, there was this system called patronage. where the emperor was kind of the chief benefactor, and then other chief people in the empire were benefactors as well. And what I mean by that is they showed partiality to people, right? It was kind of a corrupt system, but it was all they had known, really. It's kind of like, you know, you think about in India the caste system that was there for so long. It seems so foreign to us, but it's just really ingrained in their culture, right? So to them, they would actually almost, they would give these festivals to the emperor or to chief men in the Roman empire, and they would basically be worshiping people, these people, almost like they were gods, or just, you know, do everything to kind of swear their allegiance to them. And in return, the benefactors would, you know, give them some economic advantage or provide things for them. And so there's this this elaborate system of relationships of a patron and a client, okay? And I don't know how much this plays into the Thessalonian letters, but I think it's interesting. I don't think it should be dismissed, because what is the one thing, one of the things that Paul is really has to get on to Thessalonica about in regard to money and work? What do the Thessalonian brethren have trouble with? In 2 Thessalonians 3, he mentions those that are disorderly. And particularly in that chapter, who are the disorderly?
Those that are busybodies and not really working anything.
Okay, so they weren't working, right? I mean, in the Thessalonian letters, you have these statements like, if any man will not work, neither should he eat, right? Or if there's anybody that's walking disorderly among you, withdraw yourselves, because we hear that there are some that are disorderly, that they're working not at all, but are busybodies, right? They're not busy working, they're busybodies in other people's matters. So where do these people get the income to stop working and kind of meddle in other people's business? Could part of it be this kind of patron-client relationship that was kind of ingrained in the culture? Maybe. And think about this, too, before we stop. Let's suppose as far as the religion, these free citizens, you know, they have their rulers of the city. And I've looked at the history of the rulers of the city, and some of them were high priests in the imperial cult, which had its temple there and everything. Imagine if you're in the imperial cult and you're worshiping the emperor and you're getting all of these benefits from the emperor, you have your way paid. And then, like, maybe say you're one of the chief women that it mentioned in Acts 17 there. And then Paul and his companions come by and they start preaching the truth, and you recognize, you know, maybe you've seen enough in life that you know that you're starting to question this imperial cult or whatever, and then you realize, you know, this that Paul and his companions are preaching is bona fide, it's authentic, as opposed to what I've been doing, and so you convert from that. What's going to happen with your livelihood? You're going to be in a tough situation, right? So we're going to find this in a lot of things in Thessalonians' lives, is whether it's persecution from the Jews that were envious in the city, or whether it's persecution from the Romans who just don't understand where they stand, or whether it's them not participating anymore in the religions. Converting to Christ in their city is not exactly like it is in our city, right? It's not like in Flatwoods, Kentucky in 2015, that if I am baptized, I don't have any income after I do that, right? And so because it cost them a lot, do you think that Christianity meant a lot to them? I think it did. And what's the one difference between somebody that converts to Christ and somebody that becomes a worshiper of any of these other idols? If you add another idol to the people that are worshiping 100 gods, does that really change anything? I mean, they worship the Egyptian gods, and they worship the gods on Mount Olympus, and they worshiped Roman gods. So adding another god was really no problem in that sense. But what was distinct about converting to Christ? Were you just adding another god to the plethora of gods? You were renouncing all others, weren't you? So immediately you would be in trouble with your work or with the society in which you lived.
We have some of that problem today.
Yeah.
With people converting over to Christianity, with some of the occupations they have.
Yeah.
You know, it, they can't keep that lifestyle. They can't keep that.
Yeah.
Affiliation. You know, they have to give it up.
So, I think that that is going to kind of paint the picture a little bit for some of the things as far as their fellowship and their faith, because it meant a lot to them, didn't it? Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to take a break for about 10 minutes, not 10 minutes, 5 minutes, sorry, and then we'll get back, and I'll try to see if I can get my remote working, because that would be great. So take a short break. All right, continue where we left off. If you turn over to Acts 17, and that's kind of where we're camping, at least for right now, you find that in Acts 17, Paul, when he comes to Athens, in verse 16, the Bible mentions, Dr. Luke doing the recording, says he saw that the city was wholly given to idolatry. I would say that Thessalonica, in a lot of ways, could be described similarly to Athens. It's hard for us to get a very full picture of the gamut of gods that the Thessalonians would worship in the first century, partly because you know, some excavation projects and stuff are kind of hindered because there are people still living there and inhabiting it. I mean, there are pictures I have of the ruins of that they're excavating right next to, like, big apartment buildings. You know, I mean, so it's hard for us to get a full picture of it, but we have enough to kind of at least paint a partial picture of what, you know, what they would have been involved in before they became Christians. Now, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9 mentions something particular about the people at Corinth that's not really mentioned, I guess, as specifically to in other epistles of Paul to congregations. The particular thing about Thessalonica was this. It says, they themselves show us of what manner of entering in we had unto you, how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Involved in these idols, we mentioned the Roman benefactors, which we're going to mention a little bit more. So that would be the emperor. Okay, on the coinage in those days, Julius Caesar was looked at as being a god, and then they would have Tiberius's, Augustus. On the coin, and he would be a son of the gods. Okay, so they were treating it that way. And then, you know, the emperor at the time was probably treated like a god too. On the side of that, they also probably had a cult to Roma, which was kind of the goddess that represented the city of Rome. But aside from the Roman deities that were particularly Roman, the Romans kind of worshipped the Greek pantheon of gods, didn't they? I mean, they really just kind of borrowed them and put their own names to them. If you go to this to the next page, I meant to have numbers on this, but you have the 12 Olympians here, and I mentioned their Roman names, but you might know in parentheses their Greek names better. So you have Jupiter or Zeus, Juno or Herod, Neptune or Poseidon. You have all 12 of those that are mentioned there. Those were the 12 Olympians. Now, Mount Olympus was just, I'll stay stone's throw, but it's probably a little longer than a stone's throw. Mount Olympus was pretty close to Thessalonica. I mean, it was just south of Thessalonica. And so they still had that kind of that Greek Macedonian heritage in the city. And so, especially the fact that the Romans kind of just borrowed and renamed the Greek gods, the Olympians were worshipped right along with the Roman emperors as deity as well. And then we have this interesting excavation of the Serapeum, which is kind of a temple dedicated to an Egyptian host of gods. And so, included in that, there would be Serapis, Isis, Anubis, and there are inscriptions in Thessalonica that are just written right along, praises to those gods right along with Zeus, which would be the Greek god. Okay, and so you had, you know, all of these different gods kind of competing for the attention of people's hearts and minds, I guess. And then you had Cabirus, and I've read a little bit about Cabirus from different sources. I was looking the other day at a source of Seventh-day Adventist adult Bible study lesson series, and it had all this stuff to say about Cabirus. And the interesting thing was, I tried to look it up in other places, and I couldn't find where they were getting it from. So, some people make a big deal about the Cabirus cult, but basically, the idea was this: Cabirus was kind of a son of Zeus, or a grandson. The Cabiri were gods that were being worshipped in Samothrace in Acts 16:11, and Samothrace had a connection to the city of Thessalonica, because Thessalonica, their king of Macedon, Perseus, fled to Samothrace, you know, when the Romans took the city. And so there was kind of this connection there, and I think that's probably where the Cabirus worship came. But Samothrace, they worshiped both the Father and the Son, but Thessalonica just worshiped the Son, Cabirus. And so I guess what they make a big deal about is, and that thing I was mentioning, is they believe that Cabirus was going to come and kind of stick up for the poor, or that he had come and done that. And they believe that he was actually killed, you know, he was martyred for the cause, and that he was going to come back and deliver the people, okay? And so they have this idea that he shed his blood in order to save the people, and that he's coming back. Does that sound like anything to you? Does that sound like a familiar story to you? Here's the thing about that. I tried to do as much digging as I could, and I couldn't really find any proof that that myth existed in the first century when Paul came into the city. Okay, I know it existed later, and I know there are some people that mention how the cult of the Cabirus was kind of a rival cult to the imperial cult, you know, that worshipped the emperor. And so the Christians might have been lumped together with the Cabirus cult because they had so many similar ideas. But again, I can't find any evidence that they existed in the first century. I know that there was some worship to Cabirus, but that whole myth. So I've kind of just decided that maybe it could be the case that the Cabirus cult got that idea from somewhere, right? I mean, do people borrow? Did the Romans borrow gods from the Greeks? I mean, let's just rename them and, you know. So I kind of wonder if perhaps the Cabirus cult got their story or their hopes from the true thing, and they just kind of made a counterfeit claim or something. See what I'm saying? So there's that idea. Now, think about this. Whether it came first or not, look with me at a few things in the epistles of 1 and 2 Thessalonians that kind of fit with what we're talking about here. 1 Thessalonians 2, and let's look at verse 12. And who would like to read? Mark Ates, would you like to read?
Yeah, 2 and verse 12. That you would walk worthy of God who calls you in his own kingdom and glory.
Okay. Paul mentions kingdom and glory, doesn't he? So you kind of mix this idea that somebody's coming back and they're going to deliver the poor and they're really going to be a rival to Caesar. The preaching of a kingdom was part of what Paul mentioned to them, isn't it? Go to 2 Thessalonians. Chapter 1, verse 5. Who'd like to read that? JC, would you like to read that for us?
Which is a manifest token of the righteousness judgment of God, that you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God, for which you also suffer.
Okay. And then let's look at verses 9 and 10. Jerry, can you read that?
2 Thessalonians 1, 9 and 10. Who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and the glory of his power, when he shall come to be glorified in his saints and to be admired in all them that believe, because our testimony among you was believed in that day.
Okay, so the idea that Christ was coming, that you're part of his kingdom, but you're going to be conveyed, you know, you're going to see the fullness of the kingdom when he comes back, in the sense of the heavenly revelation of it, and that he's going to come back to fight for you. That was taught to the Thessalonians, wasn't it? And however we pieced together that Kabbalah's cult, I think it's interesting that how similar they made it to that. It makes me wonder that there was some sort of void in the lives of these people. You know, how did they worship some of these gods? Like the Greek, how did they worship Aphrodite? Goddess of romance and sexual love. You could probably imagine how they would worship, right? Is it any wonder that when you go to 1 Thessalonians 4, that he says to them in 1 Thessalonians 4 that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor, not in the lust of concupiscence, even as the Gentiles which know not God. And so there in 1 Thessalonians 4, he's kind of talking about you don't need to go to your former lust. In fact, in verse 3, he said that you should abstain from fornication. If you had lived a life that was a worship to those Greek gods, you know, there's a lot of fleshly things involved in that, and there's probably an emptiness there, and the gospel of Christ can fill that void that these false religions couldn't, right? There's that idea there, okay? And then we have the Jewish synagogue, right? The Jewish synagogue is where Paul went first. Why did Paul go to the Jewish synagogue first? Did he always do that? Is that his? What does Romans 1:16 say? I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for the power of God to salvation to everyone that believes.
To the Jew first.
To the Jew first. The Jew. So Paul went to that Jewish synagogue first, right? So that's where he spent those three weeks reasoning with them out of the scriptures, and so apparently there was. A significant Jewish population that taught the truth of the gospel there. Okay, does anybody have any questions about this before we go on? I did want to mention, just because it's such a big thing, I want to mention a little bit more about this whole idea of the benefactors, if you all don't mind, before we go on. Let's read a few of these passages about work. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians 4. Here real quick and look at verse 11 and 12. And Greg Hall, would you like to read that?
Yes. And that you study to be quiet and to do your own business and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, that you may walk honestly towards them that are without, and that you may have lack of nothing.
Okay. So Paul emphasizes work there. Let's go to 2 Thessalonians 3 real quick. Verse 6 beginning says, we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly, and not after the tradition which you have received of us. For yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we behave not ourselves disorderly among you, neither did we eat any man's bread for naught, but wrought with labor and travail night and day, that we might not be chargeable to any of you, not because we have not power, but to make ourselves an example unto you to follow us. For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. Now them that are such we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work and eat their own bread. But ye, brethren, be not weary in well-doing. And if any man obey not our word by this epistle, note that man and have no company with him, that he may be ashamed. So, Paul gives more of an extensive thing there, because I think it's becoming more of a serious issue. This idea of patronage that was so ingrained in their culture was really a kind of a sticking point with that Paul had to really get to them about. You know, the Bible, you know, Paul, in writing to them, taught them that Christians help one another out. Let's suppose somebody didn't have money to make ends meet in the first century church. How was the church to respond to that? Supposed to help that person, right? So Paul didn't neglect the idea that if somebody really didn't have the means to get by, that you wouldn't support him. I mean, he did point that idea out. But the ideal that way that a Christian gets money is not patronage, is it? It's what? It's work. You know, in studying this book before, I thought that there might have been another reason why they had stopped working. And it's because of their misunderstandings about certain doctrines. What do you know about their misunderstanding of the second coming of Christ?
They thought it was him.
And how would that affect your work?
Well, if you thought he was coming, why bother working?
Yeah. Hey, you remember William Miller in the 1800s, who, by the way, wrote "We'll Work Till Jesus Comes." You know, that's in our songbook. But interestingly, you know, because they were going up there, it was 1842, I think, or something, and they're dressed in white up on that hill, you know, and they were ready for Jesus to come back, and then he made a mistake, so do it the next year, whatever. You know, some of them had really started some strange practices where they said, well, I'm not going to plant a fruit tree because, you know, I won't get any fruit from it by the time Christ comes. You know, he's coming this year. I'm not going to send my kids to school. I'm going to just have them stay at home. And, you know, why would you? Because Christ's coming this year. So if they thought that Jesus was coming very soon, that might have also influenced what they're doing. Another thing associated with the work, even among the working classes of people, their tools of the trade, whatever it was, many times were dedicated to these gods. And so, you know, there was a part in their work. You know, work really and religion were kind of hand in hand. I wouldn't know how that is, my work and my religion being hand in hand is my position. But that's kind of the cultural backdrop here of these Thessalonians in regard to their work. Now, there's another thing as far as the money and the work. In Acts 17, who were among the converts? Verse 4, it says, some of them believed, of the devout Greeks, a great multitude, and notice, and of the chief women, not a few. What's another way of saying not a few?
A lot.
Several, right? King James just has to make it hard, right? If we had ESV, we'd be doing better, wouldn't we, but... So here you have some of the chief women. You have some people that are able to go some time without working, at least enough time to meddle in other people's matters. However, when Paul is writing to Corinth in 2 Corinthians 8, how does he describe the churches of Macedonia? Thessalonica was in the area of Macedonia, wasn't it? Right? Do I need to switch to that? Maybe I need to just go to the end here. It was in Macedonia. You had Macedonia and Achaia. And so Corinth was part of Achaia. 2 Corinthians 8. Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed upon the churches of Macedonia, how that in great trial of affliction, might have been the persecution, like we're going to be talking about here with them, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. So they had deep poverty, and verse 3 says, for to their power and beyond their, beyond their power, they were willing of themselves. So they gave beyond their power. So they were in deep poverty, and yet they were able to give. Does that seem a little confusing to you about what the makeup of the congregation was then? I mean, if Acts says some of the chief women, but then 2 Corinthians 8 says that they're kind of in deep poverty, maybe it was the case that those chief women had kind of lost their means of income by the time of 2 Corinthians 8. See what I mean? So whatever the situation was, whether they were, it seems by 2 Corinthians 8 they were kind of poor, I still think that patron-client relationship kind of had something to do at least with the things that he addresses as far as work and as far as money. Now, how did Paul behave himself when he was with them? Did he receive funds from the Thessalonians? He worked with his own hands, right? He did tent making, right? And he did that as an example. I think an example and a testament against the whole institution of patronage and the fact that Christians are to be industrious people. So, Paul not only preached the word to them, but he was also a living example by the way he lived, right? And we ought to do the same thing today. Any other questions on the religion before we go on to the... Let me see if I can just exit out of here and go down. Okay, let's look at Paul's time when he comes into the city, okay, and the time he spends. Acts 16, we've already mentioned, is the Macedonian call. What's the Macedonian call? Paul's at Asia Minor, he's Troas, and he sees this vision. What's the vision? Yeah, a man of Macedonia saying, come over and help us. And obviously an indication from the Holy Spirit where he should be going. Did Paul always know what his plans were going to be? No, I mean, you know, there in Acts 16, he wanted to preach more in Asia, but the Spirit suffered him not, right? He needs to go westward. So he goes west, and really, that direction to go west, in a lot of ways, changed the course of lives of people for thousands of years since. Has Europe been affected by Christianity being preached by Paul and others in the first few centuries? You compare Europe nowadays to you know, Asia Minor and Turkey. I mean, there's been a tremendous effect by Christianity. I mean, now, of course, it had diluted and splintered in odd forms that we wouldn't call pure Christianity, you know, years later. But tremendous effect in him going there. In fact, in your notes, I have times which changed powers. And in the 1400s, when the Turks took it, there was always a church of some kind, okay, maybe not pure Christianity. There is a church of some kind. This is like your second page. Up until 1430, when the Sultan took it, and that began the Ottoman occupation. So if you go to Thessalonica today, there are some mosques that have been built there. But up until that time, there was a church, you know, at least Christianity, we would say Christendom in some term, all the way up to 1430. Because of what Paul Paul did in going there, responding to the call. So he goes into Thessalonica, Acts 17, like we mentioned, on the Ignatian Way, and he preaches to them. He goes into the synagogue, and he reasons with them how long? Verse 2 of Acts 17.
Three
Sabbath days. I think Paul's probably working the rest of the time, right? And then on Sabbath day, when he has some time and a certain audience there, he reasons with them. Okay? And he opens and alleges that Christ must needs have suffered and risen from the dead, and that Jesus, whom I preach to you, is Christ. Now, who believed among the ones he preached to? Some of them, that would be some of the Jews, right, believed. And of the devout Greeks, a great multitude. What were devout Greeks doing in the synagogue?
These proselytes?
I think they had done probably everything short of becoming full-fledged proselytes. You know, they probably had not been circumcised, but they were there, and they believed in the Scriptures. You compare that to Paul's preaching in Acts 14 when he's at Lystra. Does he appeal to the Scriptures at Lystra in Acts 14? Or later on here in this chapter, in Acts 17, when he goes to Athens, does he appeal to the Old Testament Scriptures? No, neither place does he. Why doesn't he? They weren't Jews. And, you know, you couldn't just quote the Old Testament passages. Many of them probably didn't even have the Old Testament passages. And even if they did have the Old Testament Scriptures, they might not believe them, right? But here he opens, and this is the formula here for hermeneutics, for interpreting the Bible, opening and alleging. That is, he's explaining the Scriptures, he's drawing arguments from the Scriptures. That's what we do today, right? When we teach and preach, he does that from the Old Testament Scriptures, that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, be risen again from the dead. And so these devout Greeks were believing Greeks. I mean, they might have been proselytes, or they might have done everything short of being proselytes, but they certainly believed the Old Testament Scriptures. They were convinced by that, right? And then what about those Jews that didn't believe? Well, they're the chief persecutors, aren't they? They're the ones that bring them before there. Now, Mark was mentioning in verse 10, after they take security of Jason, the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas by night to Berea. They leave immediately, and they leave by night. So do you think that Paul's preaching in the city of Thessalonica was maybe curtailed? Maybe it was cut short before he had intended? Do you think he might have liked to have preached there longer than he did? If you leave immediately at night, you know, it seems to me from reading this text that this riot, and they can't find Paul. They can't find Paul and his companions. They do find Jason and other brethren, and they bring them before the rulers of the city, the politarchs, and they accuse them. And the politarchs take security of them, you know, take bail or whatever, and then they let them go, and Paul and Silas immediately by night go to Berea. Seems like they were trying to keep the peace or whatever, but it seems to me like the riot was the cause of them leaving, right? Earlier than Paul would have liked. Now, So how long did Paul stay then in Thessalonica? As far as what we read from Acts?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Now I've got some questions for you guys. Okay, let's put on our thinking caps. Hold your place there. Let's go to Philippians. Philippians chapter 4. Okay, verse 16 here. Verses 15 and 16. Who would like to read? Who hasn't read yet? See. Okay, go ahead, Greg.
For even in Thessalonica, you sent aid once and again for my necessities.
Okay, so verse 15, you Philippians know how you communicated with me, giving and receiving. In Thessalonica, you sent once and again to me. So how many times did the Philippian brethren help him?
Twice.
So you mean to tell me that from Philippi, Paul sent a message that he needed support. They responded and gave him support. And then, I guess there was a separate message. And
it came by FedEx.
I mean, it would be hard for us to send support twice in 3 weeks unless we were on the ball, you know. I mean, unless you have somebody like Mark Parks that is on the ball that's going to do that, right? So, let alone, it's not, you know, like FedEx, the people have to travel. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it seems unlikely in 3 weeks. Doesn't it? Now, there's some other things that kind of go with this. I don't know how much money Paul had. When we were studying the epistle to the First Corinthians, we looked at Acts 18, you remember, and when Timothy and Silas meet him at Corinth, then he begins to really preach, and Brad suggested that the idea was maybe he got money where he needed it, you know, that he was working on his own. But 3 weeks is kind of a hard time to set up shop and go to work for yourself, right? Anybody here been in business? Can you set up a business and start making money in 3 weeks? I mean, maybe he could make some tents and sell them at the market, right? But I'm just wondering. I don't know. Does that have... Because he talks about his labor among them. Is he just appealing to those 3 weeks when he labored among them? Night and day? Maybe Paul couldn't have gone 3 weeks without pay. Maybe he wasn't a man of means, but aside from that, it seems like he had spent some time with them. So how do we reconcile these things? Is this a contradiction? No. Let me tell you what I think. I think that Luke records the time that Paul spent in the synagogue, but I don't think that he tells us how much time passed between the synagogue preaching and the riot. See what I'm saying? There might have been a gap of time there. And let me tell you why I think that. Go to 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse 9. We've read this before. But when you read the letters, 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 9 says, "You turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God." That would seem a little bit odd to say if the makeup of the congregation were Jews and Greeks who had been converted in the synagogue because they were already believers in Jehovah and had been studying the Old Testament scriptures. Wouldn't that seem a little odd? Because they'd come out of idolatry, wouldn't you agree? Before Paul even entered into the streets of Thessalonica. So Paul is talking about the major makeup of the church at Thessalonica is people that he converted out of idolatry. And so that's why I tend to think that he spent more time in Thessalonica. Maybe the Jews got jealous and said, "You can't come to the synagogue anymore." And so Paul just went to work in Thessalonica and started converting people in Thessalonica. And then the Jews, seeing other people are being converted, finally, you know, they already kicked him out of the synagogue, and then finally they just get upset enough that they drag, you know, they can't get Paul, but they drag Jason and some other people, and then that riot ends it. So he could have been there maybe a few months. Does that make sense?
That does follow the pattern of his life, because usually he preached to the Jews until they said, "I'm not going to hear you no more," and he says, "Your blood be upon you, I turn to the Gentiles."
Yeah.
So that does seem to follow the pattern that he followed whenever he went to. He preached to them as long as they listened, and when they wouldn't listen no more.
Yeah. I think that sometimes we expect that Luke is going to tell us all the details of everything that happened in each city. And for the most part, I don't like to assume that work was done that Luke doesn't record. But if you have evidence from other places in the Bible that there were other converts, and Paul says you came out of idolatry to obey the gospel, you listened to our ministry, that seems to indicate a picture that he probably spent a little more time there with them. Does that make sense? So I think that his time in Thessalonica, I think the 3 weeks was just his time in the synagogue. I think he could have spent longer there. And so that's this stuff right here. His visit was terminated by the riot. They sent monetary gifts to him twice. He worked with his own hands. So I think it was more than just the 3 Sabbath days. Okay? Now, as we finish up tonight, we're going to next week be studying the letters and how they relate to each other more rather than just the city of Thessalonica. But as we go into that, after Paul leaves, he goes down to Berea. How do the Bereans receive him? Are they prejudiced like the Thessalonians were?
They're
fair-minded. Yeah, they're more noble than those in Thessalonica. And so they receive the word readily. But then what happens? The envious Jews come from Thessalonica and come down there and stir up trouble. And so Paul is kind of has to leave Berea quickly, right? And then he leaves Silas and Timothy at Berea, and then he comes to Athens, and his spirit stirred up there to preach to them. Some wanted to hear him again, but a lot of people mocked him in Athens, didn't they? When they heard of the resurrection of the dead. And so I think when Paul comes to Corinth, which is the next time we have anywhere close to this time where Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy, the authors of this book, 1 Thessalonians 1:1, 2 Thessalonians 1:1, are together, which is where I think that the letter was written from, that when Paul comes to Corinth, he's kind of discouraged. You remember in 1 Corinthians 2, he says, I came unto you in fear and in much trembling. Right? Paul's kind of discouraged, but then Timothy comes from Thessalonica. 1 Thessalonians 3 mentions how Timothy came, verse 6, when Timothy came from you to us, 1 Thessalonians 3:6, and brought good tidings of your faith and charity, and the good remembrance of us always, desiring greatly to see us, we also to see you. So Paul is encouraged, and he really goes to work preaching at Corinth. He has the money now, and he's also encouraged that the Thessalonians are hanging on. And so I think what he does is he's going to write this letter from Corinth later on here to kind of correct a few misunderstandings, but also maintain or establish his relationship with these people in Thessalonica, because even though it was longer maybe than 3 weeks, he still probably was worried about these new converts, because he had left because the persecution was against them, wasn't it? And so Paul writes here from Corinth, I think, to Thessalonica after Timothy comes down to see him. And that's where 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians, probably very soon after that, is written. And so we'll study those next week. Any questions before we stop?
What, to your knowledge, is the condition of the church in Thessalonica today? Is there any resemblance of a church there?
I don't know if there is. I mean, I looked a little bit about what it has to say for itself, but I couldn't find any church website for Thessalonica today. But the Greeks have it now, so it's. It is possible that it's not. I mean, I don't think it's occupied by complete Muslim domination or anything. So it's possible there's a church there. But I don't know. It's a good question. I'll look into that a little more. But any other questions? So do you guys feel like you have a good backdrop as far as the city we're talking about, what it was made up of? Okay, well, let's have a prayer. We'll be dismissed, and next week we'll look at how the letters relate to each other.